Now listen, I'm entirely innocent of the invectives against me you have heard during the past 3 minutes, but it will be very difficult for me to make good. I shall try my best. I have been asked today, and the question was given to me, I should discuss the problem, are we in the middle of a revolution? The answer is no. Wait a minute, that's not the end. That is not the end. You know perfectly well that I know something about dialectic, and it may well turn out that the apparently negative answer turns out to be a positive one. But for that you will have to wait a little. Of course, if we take the world revolution, as we hear it practically daily, then we are in the middle not only of one revolution, but of dozens of revolutions. You read about a revolution in Brasilias, you read a revolution in deodorants, a revolution in cheese packing, I don't know what it is. Now, I suggest that we take the world revolution a little seriously, namely, meaning a fundamental change, not only in an existing society, but of an existing society and its replacement by a qualitatively different form of society, especially in the economic and political structure, but also in the culture as a whole. If we take this as our guidance, I'm afraid we will have to admit we are by no means in the middle of such a revolution. You only have to look around. All the classical preconditions of a revolution do not seem to prevail. We have an effectively working system of government. We have a still relatively effectively working economy with a relatively high standard of living for a large part of the population. There are, of course, difficulties. We may even say serious difficulties. There is the inflation, which by now seems to be built into the system, and a constantly declining real wage level in spite of or because of the inflation. There are the increasing conflicts on an international scale because of the imperialist expansion of the United States. There is a militant student movement. There is black and brown radicalism. There is the sustained resistance in the neo-colonial third world. Now, if we look at it, we have to reformulate our question. We have to see revolution not as one event coming more or less suddenly, but as a last stage of a long process of germination, preparation, and education. And if we look at revolution this way, and I think this is the historically necessitated view, we must reformulate the initial question and ask, are the difficulties which I have just mentioned just normal forms of adjustment of a very dynamic social system, or are they definite signs of the weakening and disintegration of this system? In other words, the reformulated question is, are we in a potentially revolutionary situation? That is to say, can these oppositional antagonistic tendencies be contained within the established system, or are they prone to explode the established system? What are the criteria for deciding the question whether they are containable or whether they are sooner or later bound to explode the system itself? This is the topic I want to discuss with you tonight. And I shall begin the discussion of this question by analyzing the strengths and the prospects of the radical opposition today, which is the only authentic opposition which we have in this society. This rebellion of the militant students, the militant youth in general, the black and brown radicals, this rebellion is based on the assumption that American society is not only incapable but increasingly incapable of assuring a life of freedom and justice for all, that it is the capitalist structure of this society which makes for aggravating suppression, war, inequality and human degradation, and that only radical change, that is a qualitatively different way of life, an essentially different economy, an essentially different total culture, with new values and institutions, can avoid the catastrophe. The first thing we have to note, if we discuss seriously this opposition, is its minoritarian character. It is indeed a small minority which is in this opposition, a small minority rejected by and isolated from the vast majority of the population. It is usually called, although I think that this connotation is a malicious fault, a privileged elite, and at the pole of the same, an underprivileged racial or national oppressed minority. Now, if these minorities are really potentially revolutionary forces, then the pattern of radical change in the second half of the 20th century would be very different from the prevailing historical revolutions. The second half 20th century revolution would not be the work of a more or less organized mass movement, especially of the laboring classes, engaged in the process of material production. It would be sparked, and I say sparked, by such minoritarian groups as I just mentioned. Minoritarian groups, which appear as marginal groups, moral, intellectual, cultural groups, but which, in order to be or become catalysts of revolution, would have to establish a popular mass base in the process of change itself. Permit me that I make here a personal remark. Among the many systematic distortions of what I was supposed to have said or written, one of the most asinine is that I hold the opinion that the revolution could be made by the students or by the black or brown people alone, and that the laboring classes would no longer be the mass base of revolution. Of course, I have never said or written such a thing. What I did say is that at present, and I stick to this conception, the vast majority of the American working class is not a revolutionary force, and that if we want to stick, and I do stick to the conception, that without a base in the working class, a revolution is impossible, we would immediately have to ask the question, what is the working class today, because we cannot simply take over the ritualized model of the 19th century working class and transfer it to the second half of the 20th century. Now, that a revolution is sparked at the beginning by minoritarian groups is nothing new in history. In fact, all historical revolutions have been sparked by such small groups, professionals, intellectual, cultural leader, whatever it may be. But subsequently, the goals and ideas of these minoritarian groups were accepted by the masses of the underlying population and translated into practice by them. However, in order that this juncture between minority and majority can take place, so that the minoritarian groups can indeed work as catalysts of revolution, at least three preconditions have to be fulfilled. And I want to discuss with you briefly these three preconditions and then try to answer the question, are they sufficient to warrant the thesis that we are indeed in a potentially revolutionary situation? The first of these conditions, tendencies of disintegration must operate and aggravate in the basic social institutions. Secondly, the ideas and goals of the minoritarian opposition must respond positively or negatively to these tendencies of disintegration. That is to say, the opposition must reflect real possibilities and real alternatives open to society. And the third and last condition, the minoritarian groups themselves must be strategically placed in the society. Strategically placed, that means they must be holding key positions in the process of production, in the material and intellectual culture. Do these three conditions prevail in our society? If the answer is affirmative, then at least the soil for radical change is being prepared. The soil for radical change, but not more. Four, there is no inexorable law in history, and even a complete revolutionary situation can be defeated, can be betrayed, can be suffocated. History is full of such abortive and defeated revolutions. In other words, the counter-revolution is always there, even prior to the revolution, always there, ready to strike. And today, in our own period, this counter-revolution, a preventive counter-revolution because it is occurring before the revolution has occurred, this counter-revolution is at present being organized on an international level. The first tendency, tendencies of disintegration at the base of the existing society. A first glance at the facts seems to speak against such a thesis. We have a growing social wealth, a stable, uncontested form of government, a high level of productivity and a relatively high standard of living, and large parts of organized labor have become one of the strongest pillars of the established system. To be sure, there are plenty of negative features. There's abject poverty in the United States, glaring inequality, racism. There's the increasing pollution of physical and mental resources, a murderous, immoral, and genocidal war in Southeast Asia, the continued repression of civil rights and liberties at home, a rising crime rate. There are the prisons and mental institutions of the system. There's institutionalized violence. But again, the question arises, cannot all this be reduced, if not eliminated, within the framework of the established system? Does one have to expect the destruction of the most productive social system in history for the risk of a total revolution? Well, there may be strong doubts about the character of this productivity and what it does to man and to the human environment. But I suggest that at least for the time being, we suspend such allegedly extraneous, unscientific, moral considerations, and instead ask the question whether it is not precisely this productivity itself, and precisely the tremendous capacity of this system, which comes into increasing conflict with the established institutions and with the requirements, moral and political, of the established institutions. This is, of course, a classical Marxian formulation. But I must confess that I have not yet found any compelling reason why I should refrain from using concepts which I consider as the ones which most adequately comprehend and still today comprehend the dynamic of the capitalist system. I shall therefore continue to use Marxist not formulas but concepts. Now I shall just enumerate the obvious economic and political conflicts which permeate our society, and only the most obvious ones. It is a conflict between the growing and intensified productivity of labor on the one side and the threat of technological unemployment on the other. It is a conflict between the possible conquest of scarcity and the satisfaction of human needs the world over, and continued poverty, waste, plant obsolescence on the other. It is finally the conflict between imperialist expansion on the one side and the growing national liberation movements in the third world on the other. And it seems that these conflicts indeed permeate the entire society, that they motivate our domestic as well as foreign policy, and that they enter increasingly, and in spite of methodical repression, the consciousness and the unconscious of the people. And these conflicts are nothing incidental. They are brought about by the very achievements of this society, and thus they are the token of its growth and its power, and at the same time they indicate its limits, its regression, its decline. And here we come to the second condition. the ideas and goals of the radical opposition today must respond to a need and sentiment in the society at large, and I believe that inasmuch as the ideas and goals of the opposition are nothing then the articulate formulation of these basic conflicts, they indeed do so. Now, what are the ideas and goals of the militant opposition today? You know perfectly well that it is said again and again, they are simply negative, and there is nothing positive they have to offer. What are these negative goals? A society without war, without organized violence, without exploitation, what you may call a libertarian or humanitarian socialism. A qualitatively different way of life, an essentially new culture generated by men and women whose sensibility, instinct, and intelligence are no longer mutilated by the needs and requirements of an exploitative society. If you call that negative, I can't go along with it anymore. To me, this is the most positive goal ever formulated during my lifetime. Now, while these goals and ideas are certainly not those of the masses, I believe that there is among the population as a whole a large, a heavy feeling of frustration, resentment, aggressiveness, which is rooted in the society rather than in specific private individual psychological complexes. The feeling that the established mode of production and the performances required by it, that the entire hierarchical division of labor and authority are mentally and physically intolerable, inhuman, that they are still necessary only in terms of the preservation of the existing system, and that the human costs of this sort of progress and prosperity are simply too high. And there is a diffuse feeling, this inarticulate rebellion, which finds expression, I think for the first time on a larger scale, in the behavior of people at work. Indifference, hatred, nausea, giving rise even to spontaneous individual acts of sabotage or refusal, the spread of dope, mental disorders, violence, in short, strong forces at work, weakening the moral fiber, the work discipline indispensable for the continued growth of the system. Well, one can still laugh off all this by saying these are mere psychological, ideological considerations which do not affect the base of society. One could still laugh that off, were it not for one decisive fact, namely that at the present stage of the development, capitalism itself generates these behavior patterns which are bound to undermine its function. Let me explain. The runaway productivity and production stimulates ever new needs which seek satisfaction on the market. spending triumphs over savings. One of the most fundamental principles of classical capitalism, namely saving for profitable investments, is being reversed in the tendency of spending, the Keynesian revolution with a vengeance. Renunciation of comfort and pleasure in favor of productive and profitable performances becomes ever more obsolete and undesirable. The consumer society eats up the producer society. Entertainment industries and all kinds of services encroach upon the so-called productive sector of society. In short, the social need for repression becomes less and less necessary. This would still be all right, would still be progress, were it not for the fact that at the same time the unequal distribution of wealth and poverty are going on, and that relaxation of these socially required repressions and inequalities would indeed be far more than a reform of the existing system. It would require a redirection of technical progress beyond the framework of the established system, that is to say, radical social change on the national as well as international level. Especially, it would require the gradual elimination of all unproductive and destructive production, first of all military production, conquest of space, and any idiocies, as long as the earth still offers much too much in order to conquer. It would mean planned production with priority on the abolition of poverty and exploitation. And precisely these measures are imaginable only within a new form of society. To sum up this brief discussion of the second condition, the ideas and goals of the minoritarian opposition indeed seem to correspond to prevailing tendencies in the society as a whole, and these tendencies point beyond the framework of the existing institutions. We still have the third condition to discuss. Is this minoritarian opposition only the work of marginal groups, of a self-styled revolutionary elite, or does it have a potential base in the society itself? The militant movement among the black and brown people certainly has such a base in the what is euphemistically called underprivileged, oppressed population as a whole. Ideologically, though not yet politically, this movement is strengthened by the national liberation movements in the Third World. Now, as to the militants among the intelligentsia, and especially the young intelligentsia, I believe this is not simply a privileged elite working in an abstract, academic, artificially built environment, but that these students at large form the social reservoir from which the future cadres of society are being drawn. Scientists, technicians, psychologists, even sociologists, become increasingly important as members of a new working class. Their importance increases parallel to the basic trend in the material production itself, namely in the productive process itself. Physical human energy is increasingly replaced by mental and intellectual energy. That is to say, the schools and universities today, far from providing a merely academic environment, are perhaps the most important and the most vulnerable spots of the existing system. And our rulers know that far better than the opposition itself, because the entire weight of the repression today falls upon the schools and universities, on the educational system. To be sure, the consciousness and the aspirations of this group, technicians, scientists, highly qualified workers, are anything but radical, anything but revolutionary, but the conflict between the liberating possibilities of science and technology on the one hand and their miserable use on the other may one day penetrate their consciousness and explode their good conscience. Moreover, these future cadres, too, are feeling and feeling to an increasing degree the threat of unemployment. The result, the three preconditions for radical change, I think, are given. But they are necessary but not sufficient conditions. And they are counteracted today by strong forces, especially the overwhelming power of the productive and political apparatus, the integrating, reconciling impact of growing productivity, the better life, and the still persisting isolation of the radical opposition from the masses. Note that this integration of the masses into the existing system is by no means merely a superficial and ideological one, that it has very material and rational reasons, namely the very reasonable unwillingness to sacrifice the relative security and the relative comforts today for the risk of an alternative which seems by no means realistic. And if they look at the present realization of socialism in the world, this alternative actually seems to be refuted. Because what is going on in the Soviet Union and in the Soviet orbit certainly cannot provide a better alternative. So we have here the historical clash of two rights, the right and rationality of the established system against the right and rationality of those who fight and must continue to fight for the abolition of poverty and oppression inherent in this society. At present, I believe, the force and power of the established society prevails upon those who fight it. Is there any prospect that the balance may change in favor of those who fight this society? Even a halfway adequate answer of this question would have to take into consideration the potential developments in the Third World, the potential development of the Chinese and the Cuban Revolution, and many others. I'm afraid I don't have the time to discuss it, and I hope that we can do at least part of it in the discussion. However, one idea I would like still to present. I believe that the still real compensations which this society offers today are likely to become increasingly less real and increasingly less effective. The global engagement continues to assume the form of costly military and political engagements. The national economy continues to travel the road of inflation and growing unemployment or unproductive employment. And the contrast between that which is and that which can be requires ever more intensified repression and makes for an all but schizophrenic state of existence. In other words, there is a potential, a radical potential. There is, but again, radicalization can go both ways. It can go toward revolution. It can go toward counter-revolution. Radicalization can go toward socialism. It can go toward fascism or neo-fascism. I believe, and we should be conscious of this, there's a strong trend toward the latter, toward the counter-revolution, toward fascism or neo-fascism. A strong trend from above. Look at the suppressive legislation passed during the last year, as well as from below. Look at the vote for Wallace at the last election. And conditions may emerge under which this country indeed may become the first country in history, as Shira put it, to establish fascism in a democratic way. Sure, in the long run, human intelligence and especially human suffering will rebel against escalating and destructive repression and start building a free and rational society. But the long run may be too late. It may be too late because the human beings may no longer be there who are capable of such undertaking, capable of their own liberation. They are still there, and they must be protected. They must be preserved. They must grow up to educate their educators, to build the precarious balance, the precarious bridge between the present and the future. I may be very old, and my eyes may not be very good, but I still see such human beings around, and mostly among the young generation, white, black, and brown. Among those who reject and refuse in order to rebuild. Among those who still manage to be non-conformist and radical without drugs, strange as it may seem, who are not out to destroy the schools and universities, one of the most asinine and self-defeated slogans I have ever heard in a radical strategy, but radically to restructure them and to transform them into a base for rethinking and rebuilding. You don't cut off the branch on which you are sitting. And you still... If you really want to see the universities destroyed, then leave it to the powers that be. They do a much better job than you can ever do. Especially in the Golden State, they are doing all right. Now, these human beings are the ones who know that their goals demand the most exacting self-discipline and effort. And they know that the liberation of society is not exactly identical with private and personal liberation. It may be good, but unfortunately it is not the case. The distinction between self-indulgence and liberation, between clownery and political irony, between criminal gangs and authentic communes, this all-important distinction must be made by the militants themselves. And it can never be imposed upon them by any authority whatsoever. But they must make it themselves. Doing one thing is fine, but not everything would do. Under the counter-revolution, and we live under the counter-revolution, things are indeed getting serious. I believe that the movement, far from being in a stage of dissolution, is reaching the level of history. The work of dissent, of relearning and re-educating, must go on, and it must go on against overwhelming odds. It is the only hope we have today that the catastrophe can still be prevented. And by catastrophe, I do not mean nuclear war. I do believe that the two superpowers are perfectly capable to come to an agreement not to use nuclear weapons on a large scale in their own interest. So the really threatening catastrophe is perhaps not even nuclear war, but the destruction of humanity in a totally robotized, plastic, scientifically controlled barbarism. There is no necessity whatsoever that this must be happening. Again, there are no inexorable laws in history, and it is still in our will and in our intelligence to prevent the occurrence of this catastrophe. We still have time, but nobody knows how much time. Thank you.